Hello again. We are continuing our study of Mark 13. You'll remember that in the last episode, I discussed how the date AD 70 was really important, because AD 70 is the date that the Romans destroyed the temple and sent all Jews and Christians out of Jerusalem. And this event was sparked by a Jewish rebellion against paying the temple tax, or Caesar's tax, the same tax that Jesus was asked about in AD 30. And the AD 70 event is useful because it tells us, it gives us a good anchor for dating the Gospel of Mark. And there's a very good argument for saying that the Gospel of Mark was likely written before AD 70, because Mark never directly comments on the destruction of the temple, even though Jesus does talk about the temple being destroyed, and he prophesies that, you know, for example, in 13 verse 2, he says, not one stone will be left upon another. So Mark is quite happy to insert into his text little anecdotes and asides, which essentially are nods to the reader or explanations to the current reader about events that they knew about or should know about. And he doesn't do that for the destruction of the temple. He does, however, do that for this next verse, which is connected to the events we've been describing. But when you see the abomination of desolation standing where it not ought to be, brackets, let the reader understand, close brackets. There is a mystery here. Well, first of all, the ironic mystery, is that Mark has put into brackets what he assumes is very obvious to the original readers. When you see the abomination that causes desolation, open brackets, come on everyone, you know what I'm talking about, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, we all know, close brackets. What Mark thought was obvious to the original readers without explanation, we now, as readers 2,000 years later, have to treat this verse as one of the most mysterious verses in the Gospel of Mark. So there is a irony there. Mark thought it was obvious. We have no idea. And a lot of things have flowed to fill in the space. In the absence of an obvious knowledge of what the abomination that causes desolation is, a lot of times this will particularly get wrapped up in Antichrist type discussions, and you will get the people who love to think about the end times. They will conflate the Antichrist with the abomination that causes desolation with some other characters, the lawless one, the other characters in the New Testament. It is worth saying, as an aside, you know that if anybody ever talks about the Antichrist and the Book of Revelation in one word, in one sentence, you can be sure that they have no clue what they're talking about. And you are free to dismiss them quite quickly as agents of biblical knowledge, because the word Antichrist doesn't actually appear in the Book of Revelation. The Antichrist is not an end times character. Antichrist shows up in the letters of John, and there is more than one. The Antichrists are quite simply people who deny that Jesus was God in the flesh. So that's the Antichrist. There you go. It's not some comic book villain. It's not some secret governor of the world. It's not the internet. It's not 5G or coronavirus. It's not any ridiculous thing that fearful people come up with. The Antichrist is a theological concept. It has to do with Christians relating to other Christians about Jesus. And the Antichrist is not the abomination which causes desolation. This is not a far distant end times creature. Mark thinks that you will know right away who the abomination that causes desolation is, and if you did a 5-minute Google search, you would also discover who this is. The abomination that causes desolation was a fairly well-known phrase for Roman governors setting up their statues within the temple. There are accounts of different foreign invaders trying to exert their domination over the temple, and they will desolate the temple by putting their statue inside it, their graven image inside the temple. And Roman governors who did this as an act of domination over the temple were called the abomination, desolating the temple. And this is what Jesus is referring to here. When you see the abomination against the temple, that desolates the temple. If you will remember, I talked about how in AD 70, which was the destruction of the temple, the forces are ranging. So whether you date Mark to just before AD 70, as I do following other scholars, or whether you put Mark after AD 70, which is fair enough, there's good reasons for that as well, whatever you decide on, the fact is the nationalist forces have been ramping up around this time, the 60s and 70s, which was all the loyal sons of Jerusalem, of Israel, need to return to the fatherland, need to defend the fatherland. It's all kicking off. It's time to gather. It's time to get rid of the Romans. And it was in AD 70 this finally happened, but these forces were building before that. And the pressure was on to Mark's community, to the Jewish Christians and the Gentile Christians who identified with Israel and the chosen people. The pressure was on to come and do something about the foreign invaders. Come and do something about restoring the kingdom of Israel. And Mark is absolutely filled with comments on this impulse. And Jesus is always putting the brakes on this impulse. And it's like Mark is saying to his current readers, hey, you know how we're all being pressured to defend the fatherland against the Romans in this particular way and to do these particular things. And this is how we're supposed to show our loyalty. And he puts in stories into his gospel, or he reminds the Christians of, but Jesus had something to say about this. For example, the temple tax. He told the people, when you are faced with this participating in this racial insult of the Romans against the Jews, I want you to do it because you've got more important things to worry about. I don't want you to fight a freedom fight, a brave heart, kick out the Gentiles and redeem the land type moment around this tax. I don't want you to do it. And that is, of course, the tax that in AD 70 they are fighting about. Likewise, Jesus is saying, when you see the abomination that causes desolation, when foreigners set up their statues inside the temple, the rest of the loyal, patriotic, ethnically pure Jewish groups would say that is the time to fight. This is the time to purge the foreign element from the holy places. And Jesus says, when you see the abomination standing where it not ought to be, and Mark says, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Jesus counsels his people to run away against the spirit of the age, which is saying, rise up and fight. All loyal sons converge in this moment to purge the enemy from our midst. Jesus says, when you see the enemy in your midst, run to the mountains. Let no one who is on the housetop go down, nor enter his house, nor take anything out. Let no one who is in the field turn back to take his cloak. And alas for women who are pregnant. Again, the connection of the end of days and childbirth. Pray that it may not happen in winter. For in those days there will be such a tribulation as not been from the beginning of the creation that God created until now and never will be. And here we are having this language of apocalypse, the language of the end of days, that all the things that you're relying on will be shattered. The world is coming undone. You could, you know, in the very immediate sense, the temple apparatus and the identity that comes from being Jewish and having the land to yourself and not being governed by the Gentiles, and the identity that comes from purity and purging and right relationship with God and sacrifices and pilgrimages, this hugely important identity will be stripped from you. The world is going to change. You're going to have tribulation, such as that you'll never experienced. And people are going to be considered beneficial if they died rather than had to live through it. But he's chosen people to become through it. He's chosen human beings to be saved through it. Verse 20. He's going to bring you through this time. And there is a big sense about who the elect are, who the chosen are. And there are different Christians will, depending on what they decide ahead of time, whether there are elect or chosen who are going to survive through these times of tribulation. And they've been chosen from the beginning of the world, which means there are some people who have been chosen to be damned since the beginning of the world. And I don't buy into that at all. And if you disagree with me, I don't mind. Peace be on you, but please don't send me emails. This is one of the most contentious and fruitless debates amongst Christians, especially Protestants. The whole Calvinist idea of predestination. Frankly, I'm bored of it. And I haven't seen it produce people of good fruit and goodwill. I've only seen it produce dissension, and it is frankly rather annoying. It is not that hard to imagine that if you turn and repent, then you will be forgiven and redeemed, and that anyone who chooses to turn and repent will be redeemed. And it's another way of saying you've all been selected for redemption, but not all will choose to embrace their selection. And that's the way I think of it, that the Lord is going to, he's chosen people, he will shorten the days of tribulation. Then if anyone says, look, here is the Christ, or look, there he is, do not believe it. False Christs, false messiahs, false anointed ones, and false prophets will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the elect. The ones who have chosen to be of my kingdom. But be on guard, I have told you all things beforehand. Okay. So I've already said that I think the elect is more referring to people who have chosen to be with Jesus. He's offered to everybody. They've all been chosen. And then the ones who accept the invitation are the elect. They prove themselves to be the elect. And they're going to be brought through this time of upheaval, this momentous apocalyptic age where the defense of the old realm, you're being asked to put that aside and in a sense to let the destruction happen around you and to emerge through it. And at the same time, verse 21 here is to, and 22 is to be on guard against the messianic delusions that one will find at this time. And again, it seems to me, it's so easy for me to draw connections between the temptation to conspiracy theories and grand narratives of secret societies which are doing what they can to control the pandemic and to get what they want out of it. It's not that hard to see that this is happening here. Mark is reminding his people, look, Jesus is talking about this. In the panic, when you start to raise up leaders or secret knowledge for yourself, false Christ, false prophets, the kinds of people or the kinds of attraction to charismatic leaders who are going to simplify our problems and offer solutions. And there is a secret knowledge type aspect here to false prophets and false Christs, the ones who say, follow me or believe in me. And they will arise and perform signs and wonders to lead astray, if possible, the ones who have been in the kingdom. See, Mark is quite... I once spoke to a New Testament scholar named Jeremy Duff. And if anybody ever knows Jeremy Duff, D-U-F-F, he is, first of all, a fantastic, lovely man. His wife, Jill, is a bishop. They are a great couple. And Jeremy also has written the textbook for learning New Testament Greek that a lot of seminarians use. Jeremy Duff, he was once talking to me about these passages, and he points out how there is an anti not anti, but there is a warning against the charismatic impulse here. The charismatic church, the Pentecostal church of signs and wonders, which is an ancient tradition. The charismatic church did not begin in the 1900s, or it did not begin in 1910, or, you know, it didn't begin with the Vineyard or the Toronto Blessing in 1994. The charismatic church is about as ancient and old a church movement as it is possible to get. It's the church of Acts, it's the church of Mark. The gospels are not anti-charisma. They're not anti-signs and wonders. They're not against displays of power, against words of knowledge, against acts of healing, against sending demons from people and purging the place and restoring order out of chaos. They are not against that, and they're not embarrassed by it. But Mark also puts the brakes on the charismatic impulse. And I think you need to read Mark. If you are like me, I'm part of that world as well. The charismatic church would be the church that I probably have my home in. And I think we need to read this as an instruction to us. It's not cessationism. It doesn't deny these things exist, but it also freely and openly acknowledges that signs and wonders and miracles will lead people astray. They are not the same as Jesus. Following a false Christ, following a false prophet, just because of signs and wonders, is not the same as following Jesus. And if you will remember, there's so many other evidences in the Gospel of Mark where the people who believe because of the signs and wonders, or the people who are chasing after signs and wonders, they're the ones that Jesus has to instruct or run away from, or sometimes even exorcise and rebuke. The ones who are following after a triumphalistic power hour kind of Jesus, these are the ones that the Gospel of Mark says, be careful, be on guard, watch out. This will lead you astray, because the signs and wonders are not evidence of divine favor. They're not evidence of a proof of divine status. They are evidence that something odd has ruptured your normal world, and now it's time to make a choice. Who do you follow? And the following of Jesus and his way is much more than the following of signs and wonders. It's the following of the person doing the signs and wonders. So how can you tell whether a Christ is false or not? It's not whether they do signs and wonders. The signs and wonders are happening from false Christs and the real Christ. How you can tell a false Christ from the real Christ is how they approach violence and death. Do they submit to the cross? Do they flee instead of embrace and raise up nationalistic arms against oppressors? The false Christs raise up huge barriers of secret knowledge and insider groups against outsider groups. The real Christ breaks down the barriers at every point and associates with tax collectors, prostitutes, race traitors, and lepers. That's a real Christ. It has not actually anything to do with the signs and wonders and works of power. It has to do with, are they on the way of Christ? Are they acting in his name? And so this is where Jesus is warning his people, and then Mark is warning his people against what happens in times of disruption and instability, that there will be people who are attractive to follow, but do not believe them. Do not follow them. Do not be associated with them, right? False Christ will arise and perform signs and wonders, but do not be led astray. Be on guard. I have told you all things beforehand. Listen to my voice. And here I really do have to note that today, in our current situation, please pay attention to the people who are most enthusiastic about signs and wonders and charismatic culture. Are they also the ones who are speaking with the voice of Jesus and following the way of Jesus? Or are they the ones who are embracing militarism, greed, nationalism, and are supporting those who also embrace those things? The evidence of signs and wonders in a believing community is not the same as the evidence of the way of Christ. And I don't think that it's any different today than it was for Mark. And here there is a Mark reminding his people, look, Jesus said this. He's already told us about this. There's a factionalism and a worship of triumph happening even in, for example, 1 Corinthians, you can see this, where Paul is also battling against this idea, which is that people are following different factions based on how successful and eloquent their leaders are. And it does seem to be the one of the earliest temptations of the early church. And here you even get it in Mark 13. False Christ, false prophets. But in those days, after that tribulation, after you've seen the abomination that causes desolation, after you see the Romans desecrating the temple, after you see them invade the land, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. This is all apocalyptic language. I mentioned this last episode as well. This is all well-known genre language for the end of the world, or the end of the age and the beginning of a new one. And it is not a literal expectation that the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. It's the language one uses of your world will be rocked. Everything will be turned upside down. Whatever you expect to be solid and true will be shaken. And it's similar to language he used earlier in Mark 13, where Jesus was talking about father will be set against children and mothers against daughters. It's all the systems and places that you expect will be safe will be turned against each other. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. The powers, the unseen forces, which control and influence, and Paul calls them the basic elements of this world in Colossians. The unseen forces of the heavens will be shaken. It's the idea that all the things you rely on as sure will not be sure anymore. And Mark is saying, look, Jesus reminded us that this was going to happen. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. And then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. The Son of Man coming on the clouds with great power, verse 26, is the allusion to Daniel 7. The Daniel 7 prophecy of the one like the Son of Man who comes shining, and he takes the place of authority on God's throne. And he displaces the other sons of God, the other creatures are put back in their place, and instead the Son of Man is given authority. And we've just had Jesus refers now to the stars falling from heaven, the powers of the heavens will be shaken. This, of course, is the idea that the sons of God were related to stars. The powers in heaven are related to the ruling authorities, and they are losing their place. The way that the world is known to run is losing its grip, and instead will come one like the Son of Man, one like the human one. Remember, there's ambiguity there. It's deliberate. Jesus refers to himself as the Son of Man, but the Son of Man also has implications for all humans. I am the true human, and you too can be a true human. And the true human will come with great power and glory, instead of the stars and the powers. And then the Son of Man will send out the angels, the divine rulers. He will order these rulers who have been set in God's council. He will send them out. So now the Son of Man has power over the divine creatures who have been given authority over the nations. And he will gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven. All his people will be gathered into one new kingdom, is what we would say, or one new people. And from the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branches become tender, you know the summer is near. So also when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. The kingdom of heaven is near. I tell you this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. The generation will not pass away until these things take place. Again, very similar to the words he had in before the transfiguration, that Jesus is not making a prediction which is patently false. He's making a statement which is patently true. This generation, the people hearing my voice, will experience the end of the world. But I will remain. You will experience heaven and earth swapping places. You will experience angels falling to earth. You will experience mothers and daughters fighting each other. You will experience holy places being desecrated. Everything that you put your trust in will be proven to be false or dangerous. Even signs and wonders will prove to be misleading. But my words will not pass away. The words I say, the things I do in my name, this is the truth. And they haven't changed. And this is true for any generation that experiences an apocalypse. And by the way, every generation experiences an apocalypse without exception, because every generation dies and every generation is replaced by a new one. And Jesus says, it happened. A new age is here. But concerning the day or that hour, no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. The Father, the great ruler, Yahweh, on his throne. He's the one who governs the movement and collapse and rise of generations and of ages. He's the eternal God, the eternal one, the God of all ages. The eternal eons are in God's command, and he's ever present. It's always happening. And then we get, be on guard, keep awake, for you do not know when the time will come. You do not know when you're not going to be able to rely on the things that you just assumed to be true, that you assumed would be there all the time. Again, the be on guard, be aware language is related to martyr language, which we've discussed. Whereas the early Christians thought of themselves as martyrs, they didn't mean to the death. They meant as a witness, that was the word. To witness to something, to stand and witness. Might be to stand and watch, but it also could mean to stand and speak to the powers. The death part of martyrdom comes after the Christians started acting like witnesses, because the powers don't like it when you watch them, and the powers don't like it when you speak truth to them. The powers will kill you. The powers want to be in charge. They've burst their bounds. They've taken control. They are false Christs, and they don't like it when you tell them that. So they will kill you for it. So this is why the word witness has become associated with the word witness unto death, although it did not originally mean that. And here Jesus is saying, be a guard, be aware, be awake. And it's a common theme in the Gospels and in all of the New Testament. For you don't know that the time will come. And then he describes the different imagery of, you know, somebody going on a journey, and he puts his servants in charge, and he puts a doorkeeper in charge. He says, I'm going to come back soon. And the doorkeeper has to stay awake. And this is what Jesus is saying. Stay awake, be aware. It's always happening. It's about to happen. The kingdom of heaven is always at hand. It's always breaking through. And the kingdom of man, the kingdoms of man, are always about to end. There's always a crack in them. So I say to you, stay awake. Watch out. It's not a bad thing when the kingdoms of man have a crack in them. You're not staying awake because you're scared of the master coming back. You're staying awake because you want him to be there. Because the rightful king has come to rescue his people. And cracks in the old system is how you escape. I'm going to stop there. And we're going to look at Mark 14 in the next episode, where the plot to kill Jesus is heightened significantly.